Oh, there's been so much talk about the family. The family is an institution of society, a basic building block of civilization, an institution that is besieged. Besieged from all sides, it seems. An institution that's in decline. We've talked about this on Issues Etc. on many occasions, about the fact that parents seem to have very little time for their kids. Kids seem to have very little time for their parents. Children spend not only hours a day in school, but on either end of that school day, they may spend hours in some kind of daycare. I was just talking with some fellow parents, fellow school-aged student parents, kids, parents of the kids in school. And we were talking about too much homework, too little time for these kids to do what they need to do, too little time to sit down and eat with your children. Now, we can point fingers in every direction. Of course, the schools may assign too much homework, or maybe the employer requires too much time, or maybe parents simply care more about what's going on outside the family than inside the family. We're going to be talking about the family as a refuge with Dr. Gene Edward Veith in the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. Following our conversation with Dr. Veith, Dirk Johnson rounds off this first hour. He's Chicago Bureau Chief for Newsweek Magazine and author of a story in the latest Newsweek titled Preachers and Porn. We'll talk about pastors and pornography. Some sad things to report there as well. Then in the second hour of the program, Dr. Ronald Huggins of Salt Lake Theological Seminary is going to bring some of his expertise to bear upon Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. A lot of claims are made in that ever-popular book. Now it's been out there and it's been on the bestsellers list for, well, as long as it's been out, the Da Vinci Code. A lot of claims are made in that film about certain pieces of art from the brush of Leonardo da Vinci. That if you look at this piece of art there next to Jesus in the Last Supper painting, you see Mary Magdalene, you see Peter holding a knife, things like this. And other paintings by da Vinci. If you actually look at those paintings, is Dan Brown and the characters in his novel, are they accurately describing what those paintings show? And how much are they making of them in the Da Vinci Code? We'll talk about that. Open Lines follows from 4:30 till 5:30. Tim LaHaye, Jerry Jenkins, the very last, they promise, the very last, before they go on to the next one, the very last in the Left Behind series of novels. Glorious Appearing, opened last week, came out, second printing before it ever even hit the shelves of the bookstores. Selling like hotcakes. What else would you expect? Well, we've got some audio from Tim LaHaye on the plans for not only that book and next book and other books as well. His publishing ventures seem to just multiply as time goes by, with 12 books in the Left Behind series now out on the shelves and in the hands of readers. We'll talk about that during Open Lines, among other things. And in the last half hour of Issues Etc., our good friend Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, joins us. We'll get a religion roundup. Several things Uwe wants to talk about, among them, probably top of mind, where is the general Muslim outrage at the terrible slayings that took place in Fallujah, Iraq? That and other things in our religion roundup with Uwe Simonetto in the last half hour of Issues Etc. If you'd like to join us, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Gene Edward Veith joins us to talk about the family as a refuge. He's director of the Chronic Institute, culture editor for World Magazine, author of several books, including his latest, Loving God with All Your Mind. He's also written an article in a recent issue of For the Life of the World magazine titled The Family, a Refuge. Dr. Veith, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you again.
Why focus on the family as a refuge when some might say, look, the family is a beleaguered and perhaps even a declining institution in society, and so much depends upon defending it, simply its existence? Why, someone might ask, why talk about this?
Well, the family is under attack, and from every side, it seems, and the family can withstand that, but the problem is sometimes families are under attack from within, too. And I think a lot of families don't really understand the calling of a family and what the different things God has called us to as fathers and mothers and husbands and wives and children and parents. Those are important callings, and I think we sort of lost track of that. And so the family has become sometimes very dysfunctional. Instead of being a place of security and refuge away from all of the conflict and politics and everything that's going on outside, out in the world, a lot of times we bring that conflict from the world into our families. And so there's no escape from the troubles of the world. And so and family sometimes become just another problem that we have instead of the respite from the problems that we have.
I want you to repeat that last phrase again, because that I think is a very good diagnosis of the problem we have. Repeat that if you would, Dr. V.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what I said, but it's something like...
The family is viewed as just another problem we have rather than...
Yeah, rather than a respite from the problem. I mean, the way that the family has been, and the way writers in the past have written about it, especially in the last, well, back in the 19th century, the family was seen as a place of refuge. In other words, a place of security and comfort, and where you're sort of insulated from all of the problems and things you've got to deal with at work and, you know, the politics and all of the conflict. You come into your home, and the home is a place, man's home is this castle. A castle is a defensive building. And the home was seen as a way to sort of keep out all the bad stuff, and where people could come together, people who love each other and care for each other and support each other, and give each other a sense of protection from the things outside the family. But now, again, some of the very same things from outside the world we bring into our homes. We turn on the television and have that going on all the time, and all the yelling and the killing and the violence and the problems, all of that is brought into our homes. And it's brought in different ways, too. We bring our problems in our work to our home, and we spend when we have conversation with our spouse, we're complaining about what happened on the job, and the kids bring their problem, their preoccupations. And so we've lost that sense of the home as being a safe castle that keeps some of the bad things away.
You've used the term several times early on in our conversation here, Dr. Veith, the term calling.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that, especially as you make reference to the family?
Well, the concept of calling is one of the great insights of Lutheran theology, which ties into the great doctrine of vocation. The word vocation simply means calling. And while people are all, you know, looking for the purpose of their lives, and you have the purpose-driven life, and you're looking for all of these purposes, the Lutheran answer is that the purpose of our lives is to live in the calling that God has given each of us, the different callings. And we have callings in the workplace. We have callings in the community. We have callings in the church. But the fundamental one is really the calling we have in the family. That is a vocation. And the purpose of every vocation, and I think the key to making them all work, and the key to making the family work, is that the purpose of every calling is to love and serve our neighbors. And each calling has different neighbors. And if you're in marriage, if you're a husband, your neighbor is your wife. And the purpose of being a husband is to love and serve her. And her purpose as a wife is to love and serve her husband. And parents are to love and serve their children, and children are to love and serve their parents. And if everybody's loving and serving each other, putting the other person's need first, you have this mutuality of this harmony that is really a very beautiful thing and makes the family, really the refuge that it's supposed to be.
Now, let's clarify this as carefully as we can, Ed. You've talked about loving and serving our neighbor in the callings that God gives us. So I am both a father and a husband. I remain a son. Mm-hmm. I'm a citizen. I'm an employee. I'm also a pastor. I'm a friend to many. Those are all various callings. Mm-hmm. But you make the point in your article in For the Life of the World magazine that we need to distinguish between loving and serving our neighbor and how we live by faith before God, that to properly understand our vocation, we understand that we live by faith before God and in service of the neighbor. Why is that important?
That's right. Well, we often talk about serving God, and other theologies that talk about vocation talk about, well, you're serving God in your work or in your citizenship or even in your family. The purpose is to serve God. But Luther made the point that in our relationship to God, we need to understand that it isn't what we do for God that's important. It's what he does for us. Jesus serves us. That's what the gospel is all about. And our relationship to God is not based on our works. It's not based on anything we can do to please God. It's all completely free from him. He is literally serving us in our relationship to him. But then Luther said, God doesn't need our good works, but our neighbor does. Our neighbor needs our good works. And so the pattern is that from God we receive forgiveness in his word and sacrament. We're strengthened in our faith. And then the fruits of faith, we live out our faith in everyday life, is in our vocations. And so we go to church, receive that forgiveness, and grow in our faith, and then we're sent out into our callings. That's where the Christian life is to be led. Not doing church work, not doing committees and even Bible studies or even evangelism calling groups, as good, important as those can be, and that can be part of a person's calling within the church. But we've got to realize that the quote, spiritual things, the spiritual works, are really not where the action is. That's not where God sends us to live out our faith. He sends us into our callings. And so it's in the things that we do with our family, in the family. It's the things we do in our work, in the community, the ordinary, mundane things of life, driving the kids to soccer practice, spending time with our spouse, clocking in to work, putting in a good day's work and helping people on the job. That, before God, is the work that he's calling us to do. And that's where we're loving and serving our neighbor and fulfilling the purpose God has for us.
You note, and this is very obvious, everyone who's got eyes and ears in the last several years have been able to observe, that there is a move afoot in the culture to reinvent not only marriage but also the family. You use the word family in modern parlance nowadays, and in a group of 10 people, you're going to get 10 different definitions of what that word might mean, and sometimes diverse and contradictory definitions of what it might mean. Is there a move afoot within the family? We talked about parents who put more priority on what's going on outside the family than inside the family. Is there a move afoot within the family also to reinvent it, apart from issues like gay marriage or reinventing the family?
Well, yeah, I would say so. In a lot of the approaches to family life and to child rearing, for example, and to a lot of books on successful marriage, what it amounts to is sort of that each individual is, must be allowed to go their own way, and it's a matter of giving space and freedom to the other person. And this kind of understanding of family, just a group of people who live together, a group of individuals who live together, each with their own separate autonomous lives, really misses what God designed the family to be. And, of course, the fact is that God did design the family. He constructed the family, so it's not something we can construct on our own or reconstruct along our preferences. He really did ordain the family, And grant the doctrine of vocation. He's in the family and works in the family. The Bible talks about how marriage itself is Christological, that that the relationship between husband and wife is a shadow of the relationship between Christ and the church. We call God our Father, and a lot of people say that that's, well, we call God our Father because we're taking our human fatherhood and projecting that to say something about God. But it's really the opposite. It's, you know, God is really the Father, the source of all life, and our fatherhoods and our earthly ways is a pale shadow of what he himself is. And so attempts to get around that often miss the point. And of course, the individualism, that approach to family, misses the idea of vocation, about what it means to serve someone else, to put the other person first. And when, I mean, it leaves, I mean, that's what love entails of just about every kind. And people who leave love out of a family, which really a lot of these approaches do, end up missing what makes families work so well.
Talk about, in terms of our various vocations, those vocations got established within the family, husband, father, mother, wife, child, parent, those things, as vocations of the highest priority. While we have other vocations, these should be our highest priority.
Well, that's really true. And I mean, it's hard to balance the different vocations that we have. And, you know, we have a calling at work, and so sometimes our work takes us away from our family. We have a calling at church. I guess one of the things that I say about churches, and I want, you know, pastors to take this the right way, but a lot of churches are so busy that they actually take people away from their families. Family time is so precious, and there's so little of it. And the statistic that the typical father spends about half an hour a day with his kids. And sometimes churches are part of the problem instead of part of the solution. I think churches should encourage fathers to spend time with their families, with their wives and their kids, maybe instead of some of the activities that are going on every night at the church. And so it's important, I think, to set priority. Now, it's true that sometimes, you know, your work or your church or your community calls you away from your family. And I think we can't set up a legalistic system where the family always has to take priority. Best explanation of this that came out of a discussion of some pastors we were having about vocation is, since the purpose of all vocations is to love and serve your neighbor's need, whichever neighbor has the greatest need at that point, is what you need to attend to. In other words, sometimes I know pastors, you know, have been having a good time with our pastors and our family sometimes, and then they get a call that there's a death in the congregation. They have to drop everything and go deal with that. And that's fitting, because the need in that congregation, that death in the family, is to take priority over maybe, you know, the fun time they're having with their family and friends. And sometimes work, there is a crisis at work, and there's a need, and you have to serve your neighbor. But sometimes the need is with your kids. You know, sometimes one of your children may really need the parent right then and there. And we need to give that time. Or one spouse needs your attention, needs your time, in which case that's the calling. That's what's calling you right there, and you need to make that a priority. And so, but once we start thinking about our neighbor and what it is to love and serve our neighbor, a lot of these things kind of clear up for us.
You mentioned before the degree to which sometimes the church is part of the problem rather than the solution to the dissolution and the fragmentation of the family. And I was thinking, as you mentioned that it's becoming popular, even among churches of our own ilk, Dr. Veith, to break up the family in by age. I received two emails in the last 2 weeks about churches of our own church body that are doing children's church on Sunday morning. Mm. The parents go to church one place, the children go elsewhere. Maybe even the youth have their own service on occasion. And then these same churches sometimes try and replace the family, father, mother, children, with small groups. They reinvent a family of their own, taking dad away from mom and children. And I don't know if they're trying to substitute this for the family or what. Seems like God's small group is the family.
That's a really good point. And we have so much generational segregation that happens at school. And almost, I mean, the old schoolhouse, one-room schoolhouse, you had lots of generations, you know, of kids even interacting together. But with industrialism and progressive education, you know, it's always dividing them up and sticking with this age group. And so a lot of kids don't have a lot of time, a chance to even interact with adults. They're with their own little age group. And that gets all kinds of kind of Lord of the Flies kind of pathology sometimes. And it doesn't help them to learn how to deal with older and with younger kids. And we need to find ways of bringing generations together instead of keeping them apart. And you're right, the church is usually the place where you have the wide range of age groups and everybody coming together and worshiping God together, people of all different ages and vocations and backgrounds, and that's really a beautiful thing. But when the church is doing the same thing that the world is doing in breaking up families and trying to provide substitute for families, it's no wonder that we're having a lot of the problems that we do.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith is our guest. We're talking about the family as a refuge. He's director of the Cronach Institute, culture editor for World Magazine, author of several books, including Loving God with All Your Mind. And if you're interested, folks, he's also written an excellent book on Christian vocation called God at Work. He's also written an article in a recent issue of For the Life of the World Magazine titled The Family, a Refuge. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live on this Monday. It is the 5th of April, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back from this break, we'll spend about another 10 minutes with Dr. Gene Edward Veith talking about the family as a refuge. He's laid the foundation of the doctrine of vocation, Scripture's teaching that God calls us in various roles and places in life, and that the family has a priority among those vocations. That when the family, when father and mother decide that what's going on outside the family is on a regular basis more important than what's going on inside the family, well, trouble results. When we come back, we're going to talk about another refuge. It's a refuge for the family. We've already made reference to it. It's called the church. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues, Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues, Etc.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear that taking a missions trip allows God to work in your life and bolster your faith. Marissa Maharaj is a high school student who took a ministry trip to India last summer with her sister. People were praying for them constantly.
We think, well, we're going out and God really wants us to reach these people, but it's also us that he's reaching, and it's like an incredible step of faith to take, and just knowing that he's going to protect you, and he sends these little messages all over the place, like those people who are praying for us, and we can just feel the prayers, and it's just so amazing. It's a really incredible experience to know that God really cares that much for you.
Marissa, her sister Davida, and their father Ravi Maharaj, author of the book Death of a Guru, also visited a hospital in northern India that a Christian doctor started, and it's run entirely on faith and prayer. Get information to pray for people around the world by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. From March Madness to the Boys of Summer, play ball! Here's a little trivia that provides this preacher with an illustration. Do you know why a baseball field has coaches' boxes, those chalked areas near first and third base where the coaches stand? Back in the 19th century, there was a ball player named Arlie Latham. He was known as the freshest man on earth. When Latham coached, he ran wildly all up and down the base path. His antics were so disruptive that the baseball bosses invented the coach's box and told him to stay in it. You have heard, and I hope believe, what the Bible teaches. You are saved by God's gift of kindness in Christ, not by the good works you do and should do. Well, that's fine and dandy, but many people have drawn this conclusion. So then, they think, I can do whatever I want. Wrong. The Ten Commandments are like the coach's box. God gave them, and all the other commands of the Bible, to keep us in the right place. His place. His place of faithful service to others. Believe and be saved. Obey and serve. Are you playing according to His rules? Oh, it would be a shame for you to be called out.
God has saved me. How He has made me His own, and how He now works through me to do fruit of the Holy Spirit. There are things that need to happen in you. For instance, repentance, faith, good works. But guess what? You don't do any of them by your own power, by your own choice. They're done spontaneously by the work of the Holy Spirit.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., a medical perspective on the physical suffering and death of Christ. We'll be talking with Dr. Gene Rudd of the Christian Medical Association. He's been our guest on other subjects. We'll also talk about educational psychologists, two educational psychologists, Dr. Jane Healy, about a new study on attention deficit disorder. And what's the obvious link here? Yes, watching television. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. Dr. Gene Edward Veith of the Chronic Institute is our guest. Dr. Veith, you're the director of the Chronic Institute. Describe what this is and tell us the latest about Chronic.
Well, it's something that we started at Concordia Mequon originally to look at issues of Christianity and culture from a distinctly Lutheran perspective, namely Doctrine of Two Kingdoms, and especially the Doctrine of Vocation. So we've had a lot of programming. A lot of books have come out through the Chronic Institute that deal with applying this Doctrine of Vocation, among other things. And lately, the Chronic Institute has been taken over by the Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I stepped down from my vocation as a teacher, a college professor, to devote full time really to my writing. And so I'm working with the World Magazine as a culture editor full time, and that frees me up to do more work with the Chronic Institute. And again, the seminary in Fort Wayne now is taking that over and hosts that, and we hope that will give us a lot more visibility throughout the whole church and be a really good platform for kind of spreading the good news of vocation, which is something that comes out of the real good news of the gospel, and in a way that will help, I think, both our church and the whole culture as a whole.
Folks, if you'd like to find out more about the Chronic Institute, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the links with regular guests link. And if you scroll down, you'll find Dr. Gene Adbert Veith and a link to the website for the Chronic Institute. That's issuesetc.org. One of the things that I think is secretly in the back of the mind of many Christian mothers and fathers is an image of the model family. We see it in pictures all the time, artwork of what the family is supposed to be. It looks happy. It looks serene. It looks well-adjusted. It looks solidly middle class and well-heeled. And the family that we, husbands, wives, and kids come home to on a regular basis, even the best of Christian families, don't often meet with that picture.
Well, that's true. And again, sin is something that spoils God's design for all the vocations, and the trials and tribulations of the Christian life are something that happen in families as well as the workplace and the community and even the church. And so, but there's another thing that helps us even with that, namely the fact of forgiveness. And it isn't that there are never going to be any problems within the family or conflicts, and that we're all going to be loving and serving each other as we should, because we are selfish beings and we want to be served rather than to serve, and there's so many conflicts that can happen. It's interesting in Luther, in the Catechism, it talks about confession, and it says, well, what sins should we confess in church? And Luther says, to consider your station in light of the Ten Commandments. Station is another word for vocation. So consider your vocation in light of the Ten Commandments, whether you're a father, mother, son, daughter. And then it goes on, you know, giving examples of applying that. And the idea is that we are to confess our sins, and we're to receive forgiveness for our sins. And that happens in the real place of refuge that God has designed, namely the church. So when we go to church as a family and we're ready to confess our sin, we should think about where we've fallen short in our families and bring those before the Lord and to confess our part in them and the sins that we've had. And then when the pastor, through his vocation, announces the grace of God into each of us and is a called and ordained servant of the Word, in other words, he's referring to his vocation, his calling, he gives us that forgiveness of Christ. When we hear the gospel proclaimed, when we receive Christ's body and blood for our forgiveness, that's what changes our lives. That's what puts us right again, and that's what builds our faith so that we can go back into our callings. When church is over, we go back to our families, and we can carry that forgiveness there and to bring that forgiveness to the others and be forgiven by our spouse and by our kids and by those that we haven't treated as we should. And that forgiveness within a family, I think, is the really important thing that makes it all work, because forgiveness can cancel our failures and let the family go on and let those relationships really get stronger, even through all the trials and failures that we're going to have.
Ed, I was talking, I think it was just yesterday, with a Bible class I was teaching at our local congregation about how Christians walk into church on Sunday morning as a family, father, mother, and the kids, and they're trying to be or at least look like that model family. And just bemoaning for a few moments there with the Bible class, the degree to which we put on a facade as fathers and mothers and parents and children in a place where there should be no facades, because the church is a sinner's only club. It's for people who need forgiveness, not people who don't need it.
Well, that's true. But to say something for facades, what happens, same with a pastor, we have an office as a father and as parents and children. and just as there's the office of the ministry. And sometimes our persons don't quite measure up to the office that we hold, and that's something we have to work on. But it's the vocation that carries the authority. It's the office that God works with, and whether it's the office of husband or wife, father and mother, or the office of being a child, those are something we have to sort of grow into sometimes, and not let our personal, in other words, when we look at someone in vocation, and the pastor's forgiving our sins and absolution, it's easy to look at the person and think, well, oh, who is he? You know, he doesn't have any right to forgive my sin. I know some of the things that he's done. But it's through his office that the promise is given. And there's a promise given to the office of fathers and mothers so that when we bring a child into the world and care for a child and discipline a child, yes, as individuals, we don't sometimes know even what to do, but God works through that office to bring up the child and to take care of that child's needs, even when we're not even maybe consciously aware of what they are. And so as we sort of grow into those offices, I think that's important. And, you know, we shouldn't have to put on a facade that we're someone that we're not. Really, the gospel and even the doctrine of vocation frees us from that, because it's not who we are. It's the calling God has given us, and he is working through that, even when we're not able to do it perfectly.
Finally, Dr. Veith, you've been a father a little longer than I have. I've met several of your children, and they're a little older than mine. I recently spent time with my family, the family I grew up in. Mm-hmm. Do we ever, even as we grow to be parents and fathers and mothers, do we ever leave behind our family, the one that raised us, the one that gave us a place of refuge as we were children?
No, we really mustn't, because we always have the vocation of being a child to our parents, as long as those parents are living. And we have the whole extended family and our, you know, uncles and aunts and cousins and grandparents and the whole community, really, that God not only placed us in, but brought us to life and formation through that family. And so we always are going to have those family ties. Now, not everyone is called to marriage. Not everyone has that vocation, and Christians have been justly criticized, and churches have been criticized for being so family oriented that we neglect the single people among us, and a lot of people are not called to marriage or to parenthood. But even single people who aren't called to parenthood or to marriage are still called to a family, because every person has been born into a family of one kind or another, and that's always going to be foundational for our lives and something that we need to continually honor and be grateful for.
Dr. Gene Edward V, thank you for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
No, my pleasure.
Ed Veith is director of the Cronach Institute, culture editor for World Magazine, author of several books, including his latest called Loving God with All Your Mind, and he's written that article in a recent edition of For the Life of the World magazine titled The Family, A Refuge. By the way, as I mentioned before, you can check out the website for the Cronach Institute by going first to our website, issuesetc.org. Under that Links with Regular Guests, as you scroll down there, you'll find a direct link to Dr. Gene Edward Veith and the Cronach Institute. The remainder of this hour, we're going to spend talking with Dirk Johnson. He is a Chicago bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. We're going to talk about pastors and pornography. He's authored a story in the latest edition of Newsweek titled Preachers and Porn. Dirk, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be here.
Dirk, how were you put onto this story about preachers and porn?
We came across a survey done by Christian Today and Leadership magazine that suggested that 40% of pastors acknowledged visiting sexually explicit websites. We looked around a little further and then found that Focus on the Family had acknowledged this problem and launched a website to help pastors deal with it. And in addition, there were even treatment groups, residential treatment facilities that used a combination of psychology and spirituality, often in group settings, to help pastors overcome an obsession with porn.
Now, in your story in this week's Newsweek, you highlighted a pastor, a Seventh-day Adventist pastor in Dallas, Bernie Anderson. Tell us his story briefly, and is his story typical of those 40% that seem to be polling on this issue?
Well, Bernie Anderson came to pornography in a classically typical way. He was about 10 years old. He stumbled across a Playboy magazine, and he got very excited about this. Nothing unusual about any of that. He would occasionally look at pornography. Even he acknowledged while he was in the seminary, although he did it secretly. He thought that becoming that being ordained would somehow magically wipe away any motivations to look at porn. He said that in his case, he said first of all, pastors work at the computers nowadays. He would often, for his sermon, look up theological essays, Christian history, Hebrew translations. So you're right there at the computer, and as anybody that spent much time at your computer knows, you can. It's very easy to get to these kinds of websites. In fact, you can do so accidentally. For pastors, there seems to be another appeal. Pastors are people who are one counselor who battled this problem and now counsels pastors. Said they're lonely people. They're surrounded by people all the time, but they can't reveal any foibles. They can't. They certainly can't talk about any real problems they're having. They can't reveal any sexual curiosity. They can't mention to somebody, you know, I think that woman is, you know, awfully attractive. All these things could create scandal or could even ruin a career. Therefore, the anonymity in the sterile world of the computer gives these pastors a sense of intimacy and connection in what seems like a safe, harmless way.
And then, of course, as you mentioned, because of their place among their people, they are not wont to confide in anyone about what they, I think, would probably universally consider to be a problem for themselves, right?
They won't confide in anybody, and moreover, they find that holding a secret is a very stressful thing, and it causes people to be detached and distant, which run absolutely contrary to what a pastor needs to be. Moreover, the sense of hypocrisy is overwhelming. These pastors just experience a tremendous burden of guilt and feel real self-loathing because they are they're doing this, and then they're standing behind the pulpit and calling people to act as Jesus would.
Now, tell us a little bit about the groups that you discovered that are forming for, in particular, for preachers who have trouble with porn.
Well, they're residential programs. They are they look at porn obsession, not unlike other problems that people might have, whether it's overeating or gambling or drinking. They do rely heavily on spiritual guidance, and one of the key things is that they underscore God's grace and help these pastors understand that they can be forgiven, that they are forgiven. And when they see other pastors that have been through the same thing, they realize that they're not alone.
In the worst case scenario, and occasionally we hear about this on the news, and it's sad that it makes these things do make the news. In the worst case scenario, what can this addiction to porn lead to, not only in the lives of the preachers that you covered in your story, but others as well?
Well, it can certainly cause a terribly emotional distance between a husband and a wife. It can cause a sense of distrust and betrayal. In the case of Pastor Anderson, it was his wife who had some suspicion and looked into the history of the computer and saw some of the websites that he'd been visiting. I mean, these are the sorts of things, obviously, that can ruin a marriage, that could fill a child with terrible shame if they learned their parent was doing it. It eats away at self-esteem. And anything that does that, of course, it just leads to terrible distress and poor mental health.
And it's briefly mentioned in your article in Newsweek, along with the scandal that has rocked the Roman Catholic Church in America over the last 2.5 years over child sexual abuse, what do you think this does as you observe this in broad landscape of kind of American Christendom? What do you think this does, the revealing... pardon the pun, the revealing of a 40% rate of pastors addicted to porn. What do you think it does for the reputation of the clergy in our culture?
Well, you know, it's funny. I suppose it could do two things. It's something that when I've talked to people about this story, the first reaction is, wow, I'm really startled. And the second reaction is, you know, I'm not really surprised at all. Because we all, even though we revere our religious leaders, we do really know that they're human, that they have the same struggles that we all do. So that I'm not sure that it's not the best of PR. There's no question about that. Although I think it's safe to say that there are probably people who struggle with maybe some similar problem, who are more likely now to go to a Pastor Bernie Anderson and be open and honest about it, and feel as though they're not going to be judged, than they might have before. So I think there is that upside.
Did you find at all, I've noted over the last few years, as the Internet has become a ubiquitous part of our life, not just a section of our lives, but ubiquitous in our lives, work, home, everywhere, that references in the pulpit in my particular church to passing references, two things like online porn are increasing. Did you discover that this is something that pastors are addressing more as they talk with their flocks?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. But you're absolutely right about the saturation of culture. In fact, when I doing the story, I had talked to somebody and noted that that some preachers had said that they'd stayed away from porn for X amount of weeks or months, and the reaction was, that's almost impossible in our culture. You know, it's, you almost have to have blinders to not be exposed to a lot of this. The difference, of course, is seeking it out and developing an obsession or indulging an obsession, but of course.
So we're really talking here in the end, it's an issue not only of trying to steer clear, but also of self-control, because there's hardly a way to avoid, at least as you mentioned at the outset of our conversation, the accidental encounter with this kind of content on the Internet and elsewhere.
Yeah, I don't know of anybody that spends much time at a computer that hasn't had something come on their screen that doesn't startle them. And that's by accident. Our religious leaders are just as human as the people in the pews, so that they should be tempted is really not, after all, shocking.
Finally, Dirk, were you able to discover, you mentioned early on, Focus on the Family, who has tried to step out on the forefront of this issue for the last several years. Were you able to discover anything that they're trying to do by way of, lobbying Washington to help perhaps regulate in some way the content of the Internet, especially when it comes to not just adults, but to our children as well?
Well, certainly they would be in favor of decency standards and ways to filter porn. I'm not sure that the problem the preachers would be really featured in that overall universal concern that they have about the the degradation, if you will, of the culture.
Dirk Johnson, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dirk Johnson is Chicago bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. He's co-authored a story in the latest edition of Newsweek titled Preachers and Porn. You can read this story for yourself on the web at newsweek.com. When you get there, click on the Society section. You'll find Dirk's story, Preachers and Porn, newsweek.com. When we come back from this break, hour two of Issues Etc., Dr. Ronald Huggins joins us. We're going to be talking with him about Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. Just when you think the thing has kind of worked its cycle, there it is again. Just the other evening, I had a conversation with someone who'd just come across the Da Vinci Code and was very curious, what in the world is this all about? Eyebrows raised. Okay, let's look at some of the claims that are made in Dan Brown's novel. He says if you look at Da Vinci's Last Supper painting, this monumental work of the last night with Jesus and his disciples at table before his crucifixion and resurrection, if you look directly from your perspective to the left of Jesus, Dan Brown says there's a woman there. Long hair, a little bosomy, hands, delicate hands, folded in a feminine fashion. Dan Brown says, through the characters of his novel, that's not John, as many have believed for centuries. That's Mary Magdalene. And she's actually being depicted there by Da Vinci as the wife of Jesus, the mother of his children. Dan Brown doesn't stop there through the characters of his novels. He also says that other Da Vinci paintings also show a similar kind of, well, secret about who Jesus really was and what he was really all about. And after we've done talking with Dr. Ronald Huggins about the Da Vinci Code, we'll spend about 25 minutes with him. We have an entire hour of open lines for your questions and your comments. Tim LaHaye has his newest in the Left Behind series. His last, well, he's still got to deal with a thousand-year millennium. I actually heard him say someplace that he's going to try and wrap that up in a single book. 12 books to do 7 years of tribulation, one book to deal with the millennial kingdom. Kind of odd. Seems to me if I were his publisher, I'd ask him to stretch it out a bit, as they have with the Left Behind series. We'll hear from Tim LaHaye during Open Lines, and in the last half hour, Uwe Simonetto of United Press International, he's religion editor there, will join us to talk about several things, our religion roundup. But the first thing I want to talk to him about is the terrible tragedy of the killings and the mutilations in Fallujah. And where is the general Muslim outrage? Uwe Simonetto in the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. We'll talk about the Da Vinci Code when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.